Good morning and welcome to Dateline New Haven. The party's starting.
I'm your host, Paul Bass,
inviting you to look behind the headlines on the stories that make the Elm City tick. Nothing ticks better than Pundit Friday, which are about to begin here in the WNHH studio with the number one pundits in the media universe. Pundits like Babs Rolls Ivy, the dairy-free goddess of our grassroots radio operation, the belle of our ball, and the managing editor of the Inner City News.
Woo!
And the host of WNHH's
You
daily
like Aretha Franklin, you take
Don't
your purse wherever you go.
Love Babs program. Morning, Babs.
Good morning.
You're the home stretch of the week, Babs. How you doing?
I'm good. I'm happy. My shows were good.
They sure were. That was a great interview with Juan Castillo.
Wasn't it? I got to have him back. It was such a... And I went over there and did it. Juan. I went over to one.
Yeah, your best buddy, Joe. And then we have the flyest news hunter gatherer on the side of Fleet Street, boss of the Budget Beat and the Beauty Beat star, New Haven independent reporter, Markeisha Ricks.
Happy Friday, people.
We have the queen of quippery and quintessence of compassion, LaVos Hispanic publisher, Norma Rodriguez-Reyes.
Yes.
The New Haven independent news desk's unstoppable, Lucy Gelman.
Yes, Lucy.
We will not have today, just for 1 week, the bravest man in New Haven, WNHA station manager Harry Jones, because he found out I'm going to be arguing his position on this show.
All right.
Hey, Harry.
So he's cool.
And we do have one other person in the studio today.
Really?
Yeah, one other person on the show, the poobah of unparalleled political passion and perspicacity. The righteous reaper of restitution, Mr. Top 2%er.
I know that.
The exalted expostulator of extemporaneous exegesis, bossa nova moving shaker griot of the grassy knoll. He's the conquistador of cussing criminals, keeper of the cure, weaver of wellness and wisdom, mellifluous and meritocratic minder of melody, plow driver of peace, the driver out of demons, discord,
and dissonance. Of peace?
He's the optimizer of opulence and opportunity, the undertaker of unfiltered utterance, the erudite earl of ergonomics, the liberated lion of lucidity, the maniacal monarch of mercy, the blistering barbecuer of brain-dead bozos.
Yeah.
He's our executioner of existential enemies, the alchemist of assonance and alliteration, the zealous zapper of xenophobia, the sagacious sergeant sultan of swing, the quintessential quipper of quotable quackery, the grandee of grandiloquence and gastronomics,
the prize you get a
protector
that?
Against pusillanimity, the distinguished duke of diplomacy and détente. He's also known as the king of conspiracy concoction, deacon of the dozens, the bodhisattva of battle rap, the missionary of modesty, mesmerizer of the masses, the shaman of the shoreline, potentate of 360 state, recognized ringleader of risque repartee, the eighth wonder of the world, wizard of wise guy wazzery, capo of casual conversation, first name in flame, daring don of dope deliberation.
Gotta love
him. He's the sultan of spit.
I'm telling you,
West
you need a shirt.
Indian whisperer of wine.
Down the front and down the back.
The emperor of explosive exposition, esteemed elucidator of ebonics, top tier talent from Trinidad and Tobago, daptone deliverer of decency, maximal medial maestro, bodacious bold-faced barista bop, chess master of chill, primo practitioner of pop prestidigitation, the beyond just somewhat honorable.
Oh my God, are we still doing that?
High priest of
Trinidad doesn't have another one like him.
His list of names is bigger than
Sanctified
the island he's from.
Slayer of slow-witted. The never late for supper, decorated, dazzling, and indefatigable dunker and dryer of the dinner dishes, maximum mixologist.
You can't
Joe
get that
Ugly.
Through security. You know that, right?
Joe Ugly Show in the morning. Welcome, everyone.
Well, y'all, it's been a great show. Have a wonderful weekend.
So am I wrong, folks? Or was there something wrong in the way that a federal panel yesterday ruled once again against President Trump's proposed travel ban to visitors from six Muslim countries, now bringing the case to the Supreme Court? Did anything strike you as wrong, or are you guys happy about that ruling?
Absolutely. I think it's a good thing. But the only thing that we're looking at now that it goes to the Supreme Court, they have the swing vote.
It's stacked.
They have their swing vote, and if that goes in our Supreme Court, I only hope that they are looking at legacy more than anything else, because that's the only thing that you could hang on the Supreme Court right now. Their legacy. And it's like...
And John Roberts looks to have it be not an ideological court. But, you know, there was something that bothered me about the ruling yesterday. It was a appeals court ruling. Ten Democrats voted to not allow this ban to go forward. They said it was religiously motivated, discriminated against Muslims. And three Republicans voted to keep it.
Right.
And even though I like the result, I hate the travel ban. I do think it's motivated by prejudice. I think it makes us less safe rather than more. because we want the kind of people who are fleeing those regimes to be in our country.
Right.
But I think the reasoning is troublesome. What the judges did and what they keep doing is they're using comments Donald Trump made in the campaign to show that his motivation here was discriminate against Muslims. So he said in the campaign, I'm going to ban Muslims from the country.
Right.
The problem is people say all sorts of stuff in a campaign. They often contradict each other, or as one Republican judge said yesterday, you can't take a soundbite and say that's the whole reason for the policy. In fact, Donald Trump, in my opinion, hates Muslims, wants to discriminate against them, but he's not banning travel from Saudi Arabia, where in fact terrorists came from 9/11, because he wants to make the deal with an authoritarian regime. So I don't know, even though I like the result of the travel ban, I'm worried about the precedent it sets about using campaign comments as evidence against the policy.
It was more than campaign. On January 3rd, he tweeted, and he also made a comment in regards to it as president of the United States. And that's why they keep using that president.
Well, I guess the other side of this is there's a lesson for Trump and every other politician is that words matter.
You think
you can get elected or stir up the base by saying nonsense.
Right. But he did.
I agree.
He did. So it's now in play. So now this is the new rule book.
But what about campaigns, Babs?
Paul. It's the fact that he said it while he was president.
I see your point about Twitter, but in fact, the judges yesterday and the judges at every level have used the campaign stuff. So I'm not disagreeing with you, Joe, that added into it.
But they're adding it onto it. They're showing a big part of the discussion that he's bringing campaign rhetoric into the presidency.
And I agree with you that could be a legitimate way of doing things. I'm just worried about the floodgates that open. So, Babs, you were elected to a local office where you were able to say what you really believe. You never had to be phony about it. But when they go to higher office and you're negotiating among different kinds of coalitions, so often people, including people we like, President Barack Obama, when he ran for office, he pretended he was against gay marriage because that's how he'd get elected. We all knew deep down he was for legalizing gay marriage, waiting till the politics and the moments were right so he could push it forward. So if you were to use those words against him, some kind of legal case to prove that he had bias against gays and lesbians, that would not be accurate. And I'm just worried about that. I'm worried that sometimes we like the results, and I'm on both sides. This isn't a liberal conservative thing. I'm worried that, and they're all phony about it, like Scalia, Mr. High Priest of conservative ideology, he went back on his own position on the Affordable Care Act to try to rule against it for partisan ideological purposes. I'm worried sometimes when we want to have a result because of our ideology that we then bend the law too much to get there.
What happened here is the difference between Barack Obama making the statement that he did. He was pretty much dancing around with it. This was Trump's campaign theme. This was his who we're going to ban. And I'm telling you, on my first day, I'm going to write this in. And it was a promissory note that he put into action when he became. It's different when he was dancing around. And we know how politicians do it. It is wrong. It's part of politics. However, like you said, you don't want that. It sets the precedence. The way some
Harry Jones can't stand it. You want to weigh in?
Somebody mentioned Barack Obama, and I got to get in here.
Do here.
You know.
Harry Jones, what do you?
I don't know. Not verbally comment, but Facebook Live comment.
Oh,
I'm with you, Paul. That the politics now takes over common sense.
Oh.
Because we're what happened, Babs?
So
it takes over common sense. So now we're going back to the campaign and judging everything Trump said. When we know promises that are made in the campaign, most of them never come into fruition.
True.
And Harry, you and I do not agree on the specifics of the ban, but I guess that's what I'm worried about. And Trump said a lot of things we knew he was going to go back on, from the campaign as soon as he got in, like canceling trade treaties and Russia. But I see Joe's point. Joe's point is if a pattern is established and it's a central thrust of your campaign, you lay out, I'm doing something for this reason, I'm going to do it. Then you come in, you tweet about it again. You appoint a crazy man to be your attorney general to carry it out.
That's when you're literally saying, guess what? Not only did I say it before, you just can't say it. Let's not dismiss it as just being campaigning anymore. This is what you literally believe in.
Remember, Joe, this precedent, though, will come back and hurt our side. Because as you mentioned, it's going to Supreme Court, where it's not very, I think there's a good chance it's going to be upheld because of who's appointed there. The federal judiciary is changing. appointment power, a lot of openings. The Trump people are going to be, he has a whole list of very conservative judges he got handed and swore to in the campaign. He's actually keeping that promise, as we saw with the first appointment of the Supreme Court with Gorsuch. So I just think sometimes we got to watch out what we wish for and how we get there.
I guess I'm struggling with your analogy because what you're saying, I feel like you're saying that Trump made these promises in a campaign promise, further backed them up before he was even inaugurated with what he said, what he tweeted about Muslim banning Muslims. And then he instituted a form of a Muslim ban. So he might not have banned all countries in that ban, but he did kind of like he wasn't able to take his promise maybe as far because he's like, I got golf courses in Saudi Arabia.
No, but also, yeah, Marquise, I'm agreeing with you. I do believe he did it for that reason. I believe what he said in the campaign.
Yeah, he's
is
like,
what
I got
thinks,
business ties in these other
but
countries.
But my concern was using it as a legal basis for a ruling. I think that's where the precedent is. I think sometimes we have to see when we like a result in court, but the way it's reached, whether it sets a precedent that's going to come back and hit us.
The politicians have to say what they mean to me, what they say. I don't know if I feel bad about that. Sorry. You have to figure out a new way to dance around with these coalitions and stop lying to people. How about that? So if it all results in people being more honest, I'm good with that. Democrats and Republicans, independents, libertarians, all of y'all.
You know,
that's good. I'm good with that.
Trump is a master negotiator. And that is exactly what he's doing as president of the United States. He's coming in, trying to do everything that he said that he was going to do in order for him to get voted. Mm-hmm. Now, the truth is, he knows that all that stuff is not going to happen. But you know what? He's going to try to get it through so that eventually he can say to his voters, I tried, but I'm not a politician. You know, look at what all the politicians did to me.
He's not like that, though. What he is like is, I win. If right. I say something and I can get even the least bit of traction on it, I won. And it doesn't matter if it doesn't do what he said it would do. It doesn't matter. Like, what he does want to say to the people who support him is that I won. I'm a winner. Mm-hmm. I do winner things. Like, that's just, I don't think Donald Trump cares one good lick about the country. I don't think he knows. Like, as far as government and governing, he has no clue what he's doing.
Absolutely.
But he's like, if the optics make it look like I win, or if in my mind it makes me think I look like I win, I'm good.
My favorite moment of the week was when he pushed the guy.
Yes, he's like, I'm a winner. I'm supposed to be up front. And bless the people that work for him and have to spin the stuff that he does. He was like, well, the order of the picture was already said.
He looked like a four-year-old at the sandbox. Are you kidding me? No, I'm here. Oh, I had to swing. You know, it's my turn. No, I'm first. You know, it's like, come on. This is the president of the United States.
But whether you're first or last, you're listening to Dayton, New Haven. It's Pundit Friday here at WNHH. You're home for community radio, 103.5 FM, live streamed at newhavenindependent.org. Hey, we got 31 new police lieutenants certified. Doesn't mean they all become lieutenants. They pick from a
That'd
list
a
of who passed
of
the test. They do go in order pretty much to avoid lawsuits. So depending on how you scored on this test, the promotional exam for police lieutenant, you're going to get picked next.
Oh, it's based on how you scored?
Yeah. The highest score gets the first. Right now there are 10 lieutenant positions. Actually, they've lost a lot of lawsuits when they don't go in order. They're saying you didn't pick me because I was black or I wasn't black. And that's how that happens.
I think it's going to be really interesting because everybody who made the list, right, scored a 70 or above, which is what you need to pass the test.
Right.
But some of the folks who are now, because they had a dearth of leadership at one point, because promotions and that type of thing. So they had sergeants who were doing in retirements. And so they had sergeants who were doing jobs that usually would go to lieutenants. So we have some very capable district managers who are out there working as sergeants. Who, if they go straight down the list, these folks won't get promoted. So the question is, do they get to keep their job?
Right, and this actually, to me, raises a really interesting issue about civil service. So these are civil service tests. Civil service was instituted in response to Tammany Hall politics. Mm-hmm. They want to say you shouldn't get ahead because of whom you know or who you work for in an election or whose butt you kiss or have an affair with. You should be picked by who has the most merit. The problem is then you have these rigid rules where tests measure merit. As we all know, tests don't always scientifically say who's the best for something.
Correct.
So in this case, 9 out of the 10 top scorers are white. And as separate from race, as Markeisha pointed out, you have some people who have taken over neighborhood community policing districts, Walcheski in Beaver Hills, Abdusabur in New Hallville, especially Marr downtown. The last few months, he's just been killing it. People love him. Some people love Roy Davis out on the East Shore. These are all sergeants. They all took
not one Hispanic, right?
Right. And now the I don't think I saw any or many Hispanics. There's on that
there were no Hispanic lieutenants on the list.
I think there. I thought there was. I think one. There was at least one.
Yeah. But pretty low now.
But there he but wasn't that, in the top.
Right.
Yeah, score. But in any case, passed. He
but in
any case,
those four sergeants have been running districts. And as Markeisha points out, they
he's a top scorer, so he'll be fine.
Yeah, so as Markeisha points out, they have to move lieutenants into those positions now that the vacancies are filled.
And they promised it, basically, to the community.
I finally had it explained to me about why. Under rules, if you don't have enough lieutenants in those positions, you have to give a lot more overtime hours to other sergeants to do supervising in town. And then once you fill these with lieutenants, you're going to have people who aren't staff in those positions. So it comes to thousands a week or hundreds of thousands of dollars a year we were paying in overtime that we don't need to pay if the right people under the rules are there. The problem is that the people who are considered great community managers doing a great job with the community did not score high enough to keep those positions. So now the police department has to pick, like there's someone who scored very high in this who I think is an absolutely horrible district manager shown to hate the community rules. I'm not going to mention a name. But is this intelligent, perfectly intelligent person did well on a test. This person will stay in that position.
An initial.
Mrs. Dominguez. Okay. She will stay in that position.
Okay.
But then you have people who by all accounts are doing a great job keeping us safe and building community relations. Mm-hmm. They're going to have to be assigned elsewhere because the civil service rules say that they are too low to get the next promotions. How do we fix that without going back to Tammany Hall politics?
I mean, they just have. I think you have to decide what you value more. You have to decide what you value more, and you can create a system that sort of addresses what you value more and test to that rather than this other notion.
How do you test to this? Someone has just a way of connecting with people in the community and has some good ideas about stopping problems before they get to be bigger problems. Versus this person knows how to meet the letter of the law and do well in tests. But it is kind of a military thug.
Well, I think you have to ask somebody. I mean, we have so much intellectual capital in this city by itself. Like, we have some of the most sought-after minds in the country or right here in this little city.
I think for me the question would be is how much is the test worth? Because, like, if you have people or how much should it be weighted in when it comes to promotions? Or can you look at a person's overall service to the organization? Because if you've allowed these sergeants and the person you mentioned that you're not as excited about, I think when she was in our district, there were people who enjoyed her. So they wouldn't have a problem having her promoted and
but openly
whatever.
Violating and teaching people to violate department rules in the First Amendment and people's rights and search and seizure in the Fourth Amendment and having contempt for your community. I don't care how many people write a letter that they're nice because you showed up at their meeting.
What I was going to say, I'm not touching that. What I was going to say is how much does that weigh? Like how much does what you've contributed, how long you've been a sergeant and been a district manager, how much should that weigh about whether you get lieutenant? Like if you pass the test, should that be enough points? And then they look at your body of work. Like we gave you this bigger position that's above technically your rank and you've done a good job and you've proved yourself. Should you're passing the test, which is the minimum requirement, and then therefore doing well at that job for not just a year. Like they've been.
Well, some have been brief time, some are longer.
Some have been doing this for a minute.
Mara's been a few months and had a dramatic change. Others have been there. Davis has been in district manager for
a year. So how much should that weigh?
So, Marquise, are you saying that if you've proved through your work rather than through a test that tries to guess if you'd be good at something,
exactly.
that could be weighted in? Now, what?
I think this is the way, I mean. This is the police are a paramilitary organization. The military has been grappling with the way they decide who makes rank. They don't just look at your test scores. They look off if you went to school. Did you get a degree in the time period that you've been waiting to be promoted? What kind of responsibilities have you been tasked with that make you in a better position to lead than if you just like, what if somebody has no leadership, anything? They haven't led in any capacity, but they've scored the highest on the test. And I'm not saying this is the case by any means in our department, because a lot of the folks in our department have been there a minute. So they've had opportunities. But what if you were somebody who was an amazing test taker and you were like, I'm ready to take the test and I qualify to take the test because I have the right rank, but you have no leadership skills. You've not been tasked with doing anything in leadership. Should that person still get, like, all of a sudden you get to do all these very important things? I wouldn't think so. I've seen
them do with very high-ranking people above lieutenant. Oh, wow. When someone really had been a problem and hadn't been dealt with, they gave them a job where they felt they didn't have to interact with the public much. And it's not that all 10 of these lieutenants, who are probably 13 after retirements, will all become district managers. They might have some other assignments that maybe they'll be good at. But I think Babs gets to a point. Some of us, you know, they have definitely improved the tests over the years. Like when there were lawsuits from black cops that they don't, you know, that historically they showed the tests might be discriminated against them, or they don't do as well as the oral, the written, but they do better on the oral part of the test. Experts, Babs, nationally have refined these tests to try to have there be no racial discrimination and try to measure it in a more holistic way. I guess some people like me, when we look not just at civil service, but at educational testing, believe there's a limit to how much a test can tell you, that you can never make a test be the real judge. But on the other hand, are people saying, look, without these attempts at objective measurement, you're going to be so arbitrary, you're going to go back to that problem of just favoritism and not serving the public. So some people would say what Babs says. You try to make them as good as you can, improve them with the best minds. Know that there are still limitations. You have to be creative. Like if I'm the decision maker about these lieutenants, I sit with the people who didn't get it and say, okay, we're hamstrung by these rules. We need to have rules. What other challenges can we give you now that you're going to feel good about where you don't feel like you're demoted? But I think it's a tough question about civil service, because I do think you need civil service. But on the other hand, it really stops government sometimes from making the best decisions. Maybe that's the price we pay for fairness. I don't know. What do you think?
Well, no, I think you hit it right on the head. You know, it's although catch 22, I guess you could look at it as, but it's the price we pay for being fair.
But in the end, is it fair to the public and to the people involved if we don't get the people who we know could do best at the job?
I mean, that's a word question everywhere.
Right. So let's deal with it.
I mean, that's a word question everywhere, right?
It is. We got to deal with that
across,
question.
We have to deal with it. I mean, I still believe, you have to decide what you value. It's like if I interview somebody for a job, they come with a great resume and strength,
but that's not civil service,
and all those kinds of things. You have to decide what you value in that person.
Yeah.
I think you have to decide if the test is the end all be all. Mm-hmm. And I think Markeisha makes a good point about what is the weight of that? What is the weight of that?
Determining
does it become 70% of what you?
Yeah, and I'm not saying do you do away with the test, like everybody that's on the list currently. And so if other lieutenant positions open up because of retirements or people leave the department, the people who are further down the list get an opportunity to possibly step up. But at the same time, you've also disrupted the structure that you already have in place, because you needed to have that structure in place because you needed people to fill those positions. And those people stepped up and did those jobs. Right. And they met the minimum requirement of passing the test.
Right.
But now do they lose their jobs or
because
this
of the
kind of command and things that they
and
were
they do
doing?
They have to pull these
people
out.
So, and that,
if
that,
you do an analysis, of what were the qualifications years ago to be able to get into the police force, to be able to get into the fire, and who at that time controlled the entrance, okay? It wasn't the Hispanics and it wasn't the African-Americans who controlled it. So, and there's a whole bunch of room for bias because it's not only a written test, but then they interview you. So if the person that is interviewing you, you remind them of somebody that you can't hate, that person is not going to.
So now you're bringing up.
So there's a lot of bias in this. And I believe that it's unfortunately that they don't give opportunities for the people who make up the inner city.
So our chief is black. Our assistant chief with the most power is Hispanic. Our other assistant chief is Hispanic, and the other one is white.
And let me blow your mind another way. Our department doesn't administer the test, and a third party administers the test.
But here, Norma brought up Latinos, and I want to ask you about that, Norma. So I'm looking at the list. There are two people with Latino last names who did well, but they're actually not Latino. They married Latinos. The first Latino I see on the list, and I could be wrong, there is someone who did pretty well at number 16, Betsy Segui, and she might not make the first cut, but she's a really good cop, and she'll get there. The next person I see is number 25 out of 31, so that person doesn't have a shot at getting anywhere soon. So historically, Norma, black cops have sued against promotional tests saying that they were discriminated against, and they've won. As we saw in the fire department, white firefighters have sued saying, we're discriminated against as whites because you're giving them too much of a chance. They should just study better. What's interesting to me, Norma, is in the police department, the Latino cops have never been on the side of the black cops. Their organization has always sided with the white cops and said, just study for the test and do better. So now, on the one hand, you said Latinos have no chance for advancement in the department. They are two of the top four cops right now, two of the assistant chiefs of Latino. But there's no one on this list. The Latino cops have, or there's one, there are two on the list out of 31. What's the reason? Why do you think there aren't more? You think it's because people are denying them opportunity?
I think they're not reaching out to the community.
Well, Lucy Gelman this week was at a recruitment effort. So every time they try to hire new cops, in the last few years, it's interesting to support what Norma said. The last few classes of cops have gotten whiter.
Yeah.
And suburban. And people from the suburbs and white. So they try very hard to recruit from the city, and they make a lot of high-profile efforts. They go to all the management team meetings. A lot of, I know of cases where black cops are vetting the recruits and have been tougher on the black recruits, saying you don't want to mess it up for us. But Lucy, what did you see when you went out to the Hill last week?
Yeah, so I went out to the Hill South community management team meeting, and Manmeet Colon and Lynn Meekins were presenting on police recruitment efforts, which are happening in all 10 of New Haven's policing districts. And this year, they're really kind of upping their game. The police force is upping their game in a big way. So they're kind of pulling out the social media stops, which I think is interesting, but then also door knocking and leaving literature for folks. And as many people as answer, you know, as answer their doors, or as many kids or parents as they see on the street, they say, hey, we're hiring. They're also going to career fairs and libraries in different neighborhoods in the city, graduations. And I think this is really important. And it comes from the fact that, as Paul said, the police force has been getting whiter and whiter. You also see some cops leaving for suburban districts that pay more. And I think, you know, one thing that Sergeant Colon and I spoke about was it's really important to have cops who recognize the community that they are serving, and who feel like they have a stake in that community. And so cops have been talking to store owners, but then they've also been saying to customers, do you maybe have a son or a daughter, a niece or a nephew who is interested in a career in law enforcement? I think it's interesting. I think time will tell if that works. I think the incoming class is usually between 25 to 35 kids. Joe, I'm gonna. I know you've got a point, so I'm gonna pass it off to you.
In the inner city schools, they really in eighth grade, they should have a police department for those that want to be policemen.
The young police cadets,
just like
problem.
They did, yeah. Just like they did. You know, with years
I
ago
think
with
Chief
nurses
Campbell
aid programs.
Is starting the Explorers program.
We don't have any
back.
Of that. We don't have any of that. Not inner city schools.
As Marquis just said, he's starting a program called the Explorers.
Here's the question I have to ask. Right now, we have cops coming in from the suburbs that want these jobs. What is making them want these jobs?
See, when I talk to them, here's what I hear. Okay. They go out drinking and they hear from their people who are like themselves at these bars about the exciting narc raids they did.
Yeah, it's the inner city crime
okay.
experience
like the
that they're looking for,
the
like cops.
Okay, so that's what's driving them in.
But Joe, you know what Lucy just described? We've actually seen this for years. They've actually gone to all the management team meetings. They actually sent recruits door to door in low-income neighborhoods to ask people.
It's got
to
be something else that they're not saying to the people in the community to let them feel like they want to be part of something.
And the vetting, too, is an issue. The vetting is an issue that I don't blame them that they want to make sure that people are going to succeed, right? So, like, I remember that there was one controversial case Markeisha covered that I'm not sure she and I agreed on about whether this officer should have been allowed in the force after living during training with a drug dealer who was using her car. And she'd been warned about this for drug deals. Should she be allowed on the force?
But just goes to what you just said. There are some who wants to recruit. They want to come in from the suburbs with psychological issues. If you want to be on the police force because of the high of busting into knock raids, that's a psychological issue. And if that's not being addressed, then there lies the problem. If you're going to hold it to the standards because someone is living with a drug dealer, that is a problem. I don't condone it, but however, don't ignore the other problem on the other side. So there needs to be a balance is my point. Am I making sense here?
Yes.
So my point is we need to have a balance of information to the people. There has to be, if you see an excitement, this is why you're a police officer. There's got to be an excitement why inner city people want to be police officers. They just have to be. And they need to find it and hit that.
I wanted to also just put a recommendation out there. So Reveal and the Center for Investigative Journalism just did a great piece where they were looking at police departments and de-escalation trainings across all 50 states in the U.S. And one thing that they found is sometimes cops go into departments because they have very romantic notions of what it means to be in law enforcement and what it means to be in law enforcement in a, quote, rough area, end quote, i.e., New Haven.
And those are the cops that should not have those jobs.
I totally agree with you 1,000%. But I also think, you know, cops need to find a way to talk to local folks and say, this is your neighborhood. What is your stake in it?
Yeah, that is
Joe, and the kind of cops you're talking about, that's to some extent who did well on that test for promotions.
And that's why, look, just because you could take a test don't mean you're psychologically stable.
But it does mean you're listening to Pundit Friday on WNHH, New Haven's home for community radio at 103.5 FM, live streamed at newhavenindependent.org. We're running down the week's headlines and getting deep behind them with a panel of the best pundits in the New Haven media universe. Hey, you know, someone, I saw a crowd of big shots doing a Joe Ugly the other day. Actually, I didn't see him. I saw the pictures that Markeisha Ricks took.
Okay.
They went high up in the sky.
I was like, what did I do?
You were hanging out with some hoi polloi, who aren't really hoi polloi. They've changed that term to mean the people to the elite. You were hanging out with some business and government leaders who were way up in the sky at the Alexion Tower at 100 College Street.
I have not been in that building
and they
yet.
Were
it's got a really great
You better
view.
Hurry up and get in there, but we'll get to that.
I'm waiting for it to be low-income housing.
Oh, so no.
We might be closer than you think.
Markeisha was watching. Markeisha was watching them. So there was a delegation coming to town yesterday. And they run some group called Connecticut Next. It's a quasi-public granting agency for tech. Mm-hmm. And we're in a competition. We made the finals to try to get $5.5 million grant to build us up as more of a tech hub than we were. So they're looking out from the skyscraper and saying, over there, 300 George Street, we have all these tech labs going on. There at Yale Medical School, we have all these startups going. There at Science Park, we got all these companies that have done great. Here in Alexion, we had a company that has hundreds of employees now. We've got this environment. It's walkable. It's a great city. There's a train station right nearby. So if we get this money, we can get to the next stage. They didn't mention something else while they're... So Alexion was Exhibit A. It got state money. They moved here rather than to another state. They built, it was 13-story that they call 14-story, so you don't have to get superstitious and get up 13th floor, sort of like Joe's Tower. But, you know, there was an elephant in the room.
The CFO?
He definitely wasn't in the room.
I know.
So Alexion is supposed to be our symbol of how we got the new tech economy. And it's been in controversy that... No. They've been in controversy, Alexion, because they got all this public money to get here. They built up all these jobs. And it turns out they're under investigation, not just here by the SEC, Securities Exchange Commission, but by Brazilian police just did a raid of their labs there. They have all these lawsuits. Yep. They apparently have these allegedly sleazy practices where... They get people to send test results for their experimental drugs to cure rare diseases. They get them to send the test results to labs so they don't tell people actually working with them. So you think you can't trust really the results. They might be paying bribes to people in all sorts of countries to get them patients for trials, that they've done all kinds of shady marketing practices. So before they had already had one top executive leave, this week there was an expose in Bloomberg Business Week that said
this
that week? Like 5-6 different countries are investing these people. And this week, three of their top executives were fired.
Right. Yep.
And the place, the stock price is going down. This place is in peril. So here they're saying this tie skyscraper that metaphorically could crumble. And they're saying, look what a great tech environment we have.
I'm getting closer to my studio.
So we've all said they built that tower there by 100 College Street. Maybe we'll turn it into affordable housing.
Yes.
But what does it say about
Matt Nimmerson is going to.
With global economy, with markets changing so fast and investment being somewhere mobile and people aren't rooted to places. If we invest so much in tech, it kind of makes sense that the jobs of the future, but are we doing it in a precarious way if so quickly overnight, the way the market works, these companies can have fortunes change?
I would think no, because so this pitching that they're trying to do for this money, it really isn't about the Alexion. So it's about the smaller startups, the C-click fixes. We want more of those. We want... You know, more of these smaller tech, the tech solutions down the street. We want more of these smaller tech that maybe employs about 40, 50 people, maybe some people on the West Coast. But we want people to start here. Like, we want people to think about here, not necessarily as your New York or your Boston's, which I thought this was a really fascinating pitch in that, to me, that, you know, where everybody's always wants to be the next Brooklyn or the next Boston or what.
But, such as our economic development administrator city, all he thinks about is being the next
Brooklyn. He talks about that a lot, but I felt like the chair of CT Next's granting agency really had the right mindset. He's like, think less about being the next New York or the next Boston. Think about being like the next smaller tier city that has an amazing tech community.
Palo Alto.
Be Austin. Well, Nashville. Be all of these other places that are less expensive. So people, you know, aren't spending as much to be in your community. It costs a lot to be in Boston. It costs a lot to be in New York. God. It costs a lot to be in Silicon Valley.
So this guy's saying
get those
the next
people
wave.
To invest that money to, in towns like New Haven that have everything they want without the cost. So you have an amazing institution in Yale. I know, you know, town gown relations are what they are.
But they spin off the companies.
But they spin off the companies, and there's a new someone has given a gift to Yale to start a new innovation center in the name of one of its alumni. So like the money's there.
So
like make people look at New Haven the way they look at some of these other places. Like, and I thought somebody had a really good suggestion about, you know, making it a place where you have something like a South by Southwest experience, where you have angel investors and people who have amazing ideas come to New Haven to pitch those ideas and start their businesses here.
I thought the old bus terminal up on James and State Street was already decided as
that's
a
part of what they talked about yesterday. You know, okay. Mark Keyser quoted someone saying why.
So we're looking at having like two tech areas?
No. What they're saying.
No, they're going to be tech areas all over the city. Okay,
what they're saying is that we already have something happening here in New Haven.
Right.
Not just two tech areas. There's a George City of Science Park. We have the medical place. As Joe just mentioned, there's a new project called The District happening at the former bus terminal on James Street, where it's going to be like a Google-like campus with, you know, a beer garden and canoe launch and startups having incubators together. And some businesses that are successful locating there. And it's not just there. We have other hubs around the city. And the idea is that because we got something started, give us this money to build, to help make the environment even be more of a place where the next Ben Berkowitz to see Click Fix and the crew he brings, or the people at District and Digital Surgeons, which is the company that's driving that, will want to be here because they can find enough other creative people. They got enough fun they can have in the city. I guess my argument, when I was reading Marquise's story, and it's up on our site, is when they talk about what they want to do, the very last thing that almost sounds like a throwaway was to develop the tech skills of the workforce. Now, I've always believed, and I'm not an expert on this by any stretch, that you have to let development happen organically. That what happened, that would make this place exciting, was that Yale was here where they finally decided for their own institutional reasons to start having nonprofits help get started here and hire people and develop your ideas. That when you have stuff for whatever reason's happening, you got people who say there's a fun place to live if they don't want to be in Brooklyn or Boston. They want to be in sort of a smaller city with enough stuff happening. That what you need for them is to make them feel if they live here where the public money comes in is you're not going to get mugged. You're going to go to a decent school and you'll be able to hire people. Like one guy I know, Mr. Abadi, who launched a company at Yale. When he got his big investment to go big, they said, you can't be in New Haven. You have to be Cambridge or Palo Alto because you don't have enough people in New Haven who are skilled to do the kind of work you want to do. So I would think is that last thing they mentioned, the $5.5 million grant, which I'll bet is a throwaway $500,000 that they'll get to last, is actually the most important. I think actually having good public schools and safe streets and workforce development is what counts, because you always have the company. Alexion was actually that company you described, Markeisha. Alexion started Science Park. It got to 40 or 50 people. It went to Cheshire, the suburbs, and they claimed they were going to go to another state unless you gave them a bribe to stay. So we gave them the bribe to come to 100 College Street, and they built it up. But now they might crash. They might not. But what won't crash is other companies that then will want to hire people, investment that will want to come, and will we have the workers who will be able to work for them and the city that the executive and their workers are going to want to live in?
Well, I mean, you know, here's a good opportunity, right, to marry the reentry people with this opportunity, because.
And I'm not seeing it. I was reading Marquise's
article, I would love.
I'm
not seeing either. And I've heard this whole let's train workforce kind of things. And my sister actually does workforce development on the federal level, right? Or she does some of that work. You know, the workforce development has to really start. Like, it can't just be pulling people off the street and like doing some training. It has to start with the good school system already. Mm-hmm. Like, we have to build that foundation there. And then I think we need to sort of get the reentry people around the table and have a conversation with them about funneling some of those folks into these training programs so that folks can learn how to do these tech
Actually, I think
job.
It's a national issue with if Trump really wanted to deliver for his base.
He's not.
He would put the money into workforce development, because I actually think you can't predict who's going to have the great idea that's going to hit. You can't predict or control where private equity is going to go to start companies, but you can control what kind of community you have, how trained people are in that community, how safe your streets are, and what kind of how well your city
He's
runs.
Not interested in that. I mean, the fact that he has a conversation with the coal people, right, talking about we're going to bring coal, that's the anti-tech right there. So I don't have any...
I mean, to New Haven's credit, and I didn't go into great depth about this in the story, is, you know, they did mention in their presentation the things that they, like the different courses that they offer at Gateway, that the city has worked with Gateway to kind of position courses so they can be ready for biotech jobs and things like that. Southern has, I think Southern actually just started a degree granting program specifically in those areas.
And what Gateway did, Dorsey Kendrick, who's now retiring after a couple of decades at the helm there, she's the one who not only built up that school, but she came up with the idea before everyone was talking about it, was that a lot of these people working in factories are about to lose their jobs in factories. They're going to need some new skills and they can't come at the regular time of school. So she started having later nighted courses and these kind of courses. As Markeisha said, Gateway became the group that partnered with the public schools to start kids getting ready in high school with
I mean, Metro North is already doing this.
They have a program at Gateway.
My ex-husband started that program, wrote the syllabus, but I'm hearing that with budget cuts,
they're not going to replace Dorsey Kendrick as the president. I'm hearing they're going to combine the presidency with Housatonic Community College so that the president who's already at Housatonic.
Are they successful? Is Housatonic successful?
Gateway is the most successful under Dorsey in the state. We had our matriculation go up when everyone went down. But here's the thing. Because of our budget cuts, you can't run Gateway the way it's run with a half-time person, let alone whether we don't know the
visionary
of Dorsey
prescription
Kendrick.
So we're going backwards. We're talking about this
$5.5 million grant we're going for, which is fine, whatever.
So why don't they cut some of that? Why don't they cut some of that basketball?
Coach
money and football coach money
to give us a president of Gateway Community College than a shared one with Housatonic Community College, because she's there physically every day. She gets to know everyone in the community. She knew how to get those partnerships. She knew where people were going to go to class and when here to make it happen. She's in the building here in New Haven to make sure that her own organization is following its vision. And I'm really scared not only that we're losing someone so talented, because everyone knows who watches that Dorsey Kendrick was a hero in this community and accomplished so much and built up so much at that college, that not only losing a visionary could hurt us, but that you're also losing the position is something that I'm really...
Who thinks of these things?
Well, there's a $5 billion state budget deficit projected for the next
2 years.
And
it's always education and kids we go after first.
The things that we say we care about the most are the things we have no problems
offering up. The
problem
is that the only thrust you can cut at the state almost is the stuff we care about that hurts somebody, because you have a lot of spending that's either locked up by directive under that you have no choice on, or that it's by collective bargaining. So in fact, you really are always choosing between the community college and the group home for the mentally ill or welfare. And these are tough questions. These are tough. I believe it's a revenue question. I think it's unbelievable that they won't just look at taxing hedge funders, people with hedge funds, to have them pay as much tax.
Why are they so protected? Why is it what they want?
The reason
more
that
important?
We get from the Republicans and some liberal Democrats is that we did change our income tax structure so in a good way to rely so heavily on the financial industry and which people in Fairfield that rely too much on it. So they've, for whatever reasons, not reporting as much income in the last 2 years. That's why we have this huge deficit, because they have such wide swings in their income. So their argument is, in fact, we've relied so heavily on taxing the rich that as soon as that swings the financially, how the money gets reported or what kind of flow there is to deals in the course of a year, that we have a sudden budget crisis. But there are other people who argue that we still charge less on income for millionaires than New York or Massachusetts. We still don't collect toll money on the same roads that Massachusetts and Rhode Island even do and New York do when they come on the highway. We still don't tax marijuana, although Jeff Sessions might complicate the ability to do that. We still don't legalize and tax it the way they do in their towns. There's a feeling among some up in the legislature that we can avoid. We have some tough choices, but we don't have to get to the point where we don't have a president on staff full-time at Gateway Community College, that we can see this as a revenue opportunity and not just cut to the bone.
I just think that's not... I don't think that's wise.
Just cutting off your nose to spite your
face. It's just not. It
makes no sense.
You know, because there's no political will for this.
And it definitely would cut into that plan if Gateway is a part of this whole innovation process.
We're cutting off our nose to spite our face.
How do you maintain that case? Do you have to go to wherever the president of Housatonic community colleges to get them on board? Are they already on board? Right, do they see the vision? I don't know.
Is Housatonic as good as Gateway?
Nobody
no.
in the state is as good as Gateway.
Well, then why would we want go less Gateway, than? Why would we want less?
And we should demand that we shouldn't get less than.
And they're going to demand that you pay some taxes.
And we should remind people some to more taxes. To Pundit Friday on Dateline New Haven, WNHH Radio, your home for community radio, 103.5
He's
FM,
so
live streamed at newhavenindependent.org. How smart was it the way that Yale University dealt with that protest shed? So as you know, there was a hunger
I just thought you cursed, but I know you said shed.
As you know, that the drama's over now, folks. We had it for 4 weeks. The new union of some Yale graduate student
they're
teachers.
Eating again?
They're eating again. They fasted for close to 4 weeks.
Oh, yeah, they broke
that
fast.
To call attention
graduation day.
To their push to try to get Yale to negotiate a first contract with them. Yale keeps delaying it at the National Labor Relations Board until they can get Donald Trump appointees in, who'll get a different decision on whether they can even be union at all. So they had this protest fast, got a lot of national attention. I think you would agree with me that New Haven, nobody really cared about it, but they got a lot of national attention to make Yale
look
bad. Until
they messed up traffic that day.
And then, so the last day was graduation. That's when both sides kind of felt like Yale was all scared they were going to ruin their graduation day. They brought in busloads from, I think, 6 states. Lucy can tell us more. Of marchers, they said it was 2,500. I'm totally in. It was really about 1,000 to march through the streets of New Haven at the same time as graduation. But they didn't want to ruin graduation, so the kids wouldn't be mad at them. And they ended their fast. They had a protest shed up for all those weeks on Beinecke Plaza, facing the Yale president's house, and it was a real challenge to Yale. Saying, "You're going to tear this down?" Because Yale could tear it down. It was their property. But they were going to sleep in it, so they couldn't tear it down easily the way they did during the anti-apartheid protests of the 80s when there was a similar shed. So Yale kept it up. And graduation came, and it was still up. Mm-hmm. Then once graduation was over, but before alumni came for reunions, the people who they looked at to really pony up the contributions, they're coming this weekend. In that space in between, Yale came at 5 in the morning, ordered people out, and tore it down. Did they act smart, and did they act right?
Well, but can I just add that Yale also, they kept it up to say, this is our big conciliatory gesture. I think it's important to so.
I don't think it was conciliation. It was like it was a chess move. If we tear it down, we look intolerant, saying we won't let there be free speech, and it'll make us look worse than we did otherwise.
Right, but in press releases from Yale, over and over again, they said we champion the right to free speech. This is why both we have this complaint in with the NLRB in Washington, but on the other side, why we are allowing the protesters, comma, while they are squatting there illegally, you know. And that was in like every single press release we got from Yale. And so it was Yale saying, look how big we're being, look how magnanimous our gesture is until they tore this down at 5 in the morning.
Any thoughts on the timing of it? Was it smart, right thing to do? Did you even care?
I feel like because there wasn't a big to do at the graduation, like it was very calm and underwhelming.
Well, people in New Haven, America, there were 200
people. Such polite protesting.
It was very polite. And so the tearing down, it just made it seem like the conclusion, right? Yeah. Everybody's eating again. We're going to take the shed down. I did think it was very interesting that they took it down at like the crack of dawn.
Yeah. So there
it's really or like 4:55 in the morning. So
people came. I mean, there were folks there with their smartphone. You know, a smartphone makes you a journalist for better.
Those weren't the people sleeping in it. It was other people that came 5 in the morning.
Yeah, it was other people who came. I mean, I think, you know, what we've seen over and over again is that Local 33 is good at managing its media presence, mm-hmm. and it's good with its visual strategy. Case in point, the soup that broke the fast was butternut squash and ginger soup, which is the same shade of orange as all of the Local 33 marketing.
Somebody thought
that's brilliant.
A lot about that.
Bridges,
it's quite brilliant.
We heard from commenters, there's always resentment of New Haven people against these Yalies, and they say, oh, you have your fancy soup. I could really give a damn. And they're mad that 200 cops, half the force, were working mostly overtime and hitting us with the bill. But other people say that's the price of protest and we have democracy. And I still feel like Babs really couldn't give a damn. Is that what New Haven, Norma, did you care?
You know, to me, I find it very fascinating how these folks are allowed to be there that long with the same way with the 10th city.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? If they were African American and they had been Latino, you know that would not even have lasted a day.
Oh, no. This is just entertaining for the white folks. We know how this would have went. Listen, we know this would have went a whole different kind of way if the majority of them folks was out there black and brown.
Yep.
So, listen, white folks had a nice, convenient, entertaining, relaxed protest.
Oh, yeah. Even Hollywood people coming over.
And it was, you know, and I'm not trying to belittle their protest. I'm just saying everybody got their way to do it. So
there you go.
And I'm glad it ended up peacefully.
I'm glad it ended peacefully.
Oh, you know, if it was us, they'd be like, oh, let me tell you,
day one.
Like, day one.
It would have been a beatdown.
Be like, yeah, life matters.
Listen, I'm not even, you know what?
Well, thank you for joining us today on Funded Friday at WNHH-FM.
Wow.
Happy Ramadan. Yeah. It's starting tonight, I believe.
And late, and what is it?
Monthly.
Memorial Day.
Happy Memorial Day. Anyone have any plans?
Nah, I'd be at work.
Chilling out.
don't call me. I'm not working.
And what's it going to be like on the 92nd floor of 360 State Show?
Actually,
a party he didn't invite us to.
Oh, are you going out of town?
I may as well not say then. You know,
well, as for people, anyway, our friends who are starting Ramadan, yes, I hope it's fired. An easy fast every day. I hope your nightly breaking the fast is beautiful with all your friends and family. And I hope that you see God every single day of that fast.
Amen.
Thank you for joining us today on Dateline New Haven. Thanks to pundits Babs Rawls-Ivy, Markeisha Ricks, Lucy Gelman, Norma Rodriguez-Reyes, and Joe Ugly, the best pundits in the universe. Media
and
universe,
Paul Bass.
Who I will say you make my Friday special every week. My favorite part of the week is hanging with
you
guys.
Can we get some protest soup up in here?
We're going to take it out with the Afro Submitter.
You're going to start getting deliveries of soup at the Inner City News. You better stop.
We're going to take it out with the Afro Semitic Experience performing I Wish I Knew How It Feel to Be Free.
Butternut squash and ginger.
From the group CD of Plea for Peace. Now, we know what it's like to be free. We just got to remember to book our flight. Book it and fly free with us all weekend long here at WNHH, New Haven's home for community radio.